Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Tom Woods Show. This is episode 2423, and I'm delighted to spend some time talking to these two gentlemen about a topic that couldn't be more important. And in particular, I want to say how happy I am to have a chance to speak once again with Nick Hudson, who's been on the program before. I have followed his work ever since this fiasco began. He's chairman of Panda, Pandata, Pandemic Data and Analytics. And I'm also speaking today to somebody I haven't met before, and that's Jonathan Engler, who sits on the executive committee of Panda. He's co-chair of the UK-based Heart Group. And I'm going to have some of his articles and other articles linked in the description of the video, as well as at tomwoods.com/2423, the show notes page, to give you more information, data, visualizations than, of course, we can do in a single podcast episode. So at any rate, gentlemen, welcome and thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Tom. Good to be back.
Thank you for having us.
All right, so let me try to situate us in the problem. We're going to be spending some time talking about a period of time from about 3.5 years ago, but it could even go back into the fall of 2019. We're looking at the origins of COVID and COVID spread, quote unquote, and what really happened before our eyes. Because what we thought was happening might not actually be what was really happening. So I'm not saying there's no COVID. I'm not going down that road. But what I am saying is that there's something that seems to be odd about the data, particularly for a couple of places in the world, actually at least several when you look at them closely. And when we think about what was in the headlines early on, yes, of course, China. But then as we're reading stories about this matter in the West, Italy was, of course, a flashpoint. And everybody was concerned about what was going on in Italy with deaths. Likewise for New York, among Americans, that was a grave concern. What's happening in New York? And at the time, I think people of goodwill were focused on getting out of this immediate crisis. But now that we've had the leisure to be able to go back and look once again at what exactly was happening in those early days, the story that we got at the time just doesn't, there are aspects of the data that make you wonder about the story and what might be the full story of what really happened and what really accounts for those concentrations of deaths. So, Nick, first of all, do you think I'm situating us in the problem in the right way and explaining it the right way?
Yes, very much so, Tom. Your way of describing it, that there are things that just don't make sense, is very, very good. When I was on your show earlier, I pointed out the questions around whether the measures were working, whether the disease was indeed as deadly as had been presented in media, and whether there was any basis for implementing lockdowns in the guidelines and so on. But now we're talking about a whole new set of investigations and areas of study that the passing of time has made possible as new data emerges, as we get better at looking at that information, and as we start to have ideas about what we could be looking at. They come in quite a few categories, and I think it might be worthwhile just doing a quick drive-by shooting, as it were. The first thing we noticed is that there was just vastly different experience across regions and within regions. So, for example, you could take two different cities in America with broadly similar demography and health levels and wealth levels, and they would end the year with very similar seroprevalence. In other words, a similar number of people who had tested positive for having had the virus at some point during the year, but vastly different levels of mortality. And that didn't really make sense because viruses shouldn't really obey political borders or municipal borders. The other one is when we look at what's known as the granular data, the very spatially fine data, what we failed to recover two of the telltale signs of viral spread. The one is what we call the ripple effect. If you can imagine dropping a stone into a pond and the ripples extend outwards, dropping an infected person into a population should also give a telltale ripple effect. And then another effect that we expect to see if mortality is being driven by a viral outbreak is what's called a cluster effect. Just exactly what it sounds like. If you have a person dying over there, it's more likely that people around them are going to die than in a place where there have been no deaths. That's called the cluster effect. And you uniformly expect to see this when you're dealing with a transmissible disease, but we don't. Then the other thing that's really, really suspicious is when we look at that timeline in late December, early January, there's a 26-day period that elapses during which an implausible number of things are purported to have happened. So from the time of the identification of the purported patient zero, it was a Chinese gentleman by an eye doctor in China, from the day of that report that he'd seen somebody with a case of unusual pneumonia, to a point in January, just 26 days later, we see all of the following things crammed into that timeline. A further 44 cases are observed and decided that it's, you know, it's decided that that's the same syndrome. And this is out of a population of 8 million people in Shanghai, sorry, in Wuhan. And then all of a sudden, there's a characterization of the disease based on symptoms that is described as being unique. And there's a action of a test that's shipped, and there's a sequencing of the virus that's performed very quickly. That sequencing would normally take, you know, quite a long time. You don't just come up with a sequence based on one sample from one patient and say, here it is, that's what it is. But then that sequence is immediately put to work very quickly when a gentleman by the name of Drosten in Germany produces a set of PCR primers, the constituent components of the so-called COVID test. And the World Health Organization wastes no time in declaring those primers the gold standard. And he publishes a paper which is peer-reviewed, and it's after submitting it, it's peer-reviewed and published within 27 hours and accepted by the journal. So we go from one patient with an atypical pneumonia through the characterization of the disease, the sequencing of the virus, the production of the paper proposing primers, the shipping of tests, and the approval of those tests by the World Health Organization and as the gold standard in 26 days. And to many people, that seems a little bit of a stretch of the imagination. And they wonder whether certain elements of this sequence were not in motion at some time before, from some time before the 29th of December, I think it is. So all of these things, for a lot of people, just create an element of doubt. Then the last thing to mention before I turn over to Jonathan's particular area of expertise is that there's a certain expectation for what various interventions will do. So, for example, a lockdown is expected to flatten a curve in the beginning of an epidemic when there are fewer people who have natural immunity, but that in terms of basic epidemiology, is expected to come at the cost of much higher ultimate mortality. Because when you freeze the mobility of the young and healthy people, what that does is it effectively pushes the disease burden onto the vulnerable group. So you expect that the lockdown places would have worse, much worse ultimate mortality than the places that don't lock down. But when we look in the data, what we find is that there's no correlation between whether a country locked down or how hard it locked down or how long it locked down for and the ultimate mortality, whereas we would expect that the lockdown places would have much worse mortality, and we don't see that. And so what this does is it just all brings into question the basic transmission thesis. And that's interesting because when you look at what evidence there is for actual transmission mechanisms of COVID, the evidence base is extremely poor. There's certainly no high-quality evidence for this form of transmission called droplet and fomite transmission. A fomite is something that you pick up from the surface, a surface material from your hands or a doorknob or a dining room table or something. There's absolutely no high-quality evidence for that transmission mechanism, and that's interesting because it motivated a lot of the stuff, like the perspex barriers and the six-foot rule and the stickers on the floor in shopping centers. And there's very, very weak transmission evidence for what's known as aerosol transmission, droplets that float around in the air and are not subject to gravitational forces. And the other transmission mechanism, which is fingered, which is called orofecal transmission, which loosely speaking is farting. So of those three transmission mechanisms, probably the stronger evidence is aerosol transmission, But even then, the evidence base is just shockingly weak. And all of that together just really paints a picture that casts into doubt this idea that a novel deadly virus emerged in Wuhan in the fourth quarter of 2019, spread around the world in a matter of weeks without losing any fidelity in its sequence, causing death and mayhem wherever it went. And I think that's where I think we should move into the domain that Jonathan has been writing about to great effect.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. I mean, actually, before going into what I was going to say, it's worth also pointing out in terms of things that, simple things that just don't add up with this story. We've got the people dropping suddenly dead in China story. I mean, you've got to remember that these videos of people dropping dead in the street in China were a major part of the propaganda which terrorized people. And yet, who actually knows anybody who died, even if you believe that COVID is a really dangerous virus? Who knows anybody who actually died by dropping dead from it? People did start to drop dead, but that was later in 21. In 2020, nobody died of COVID by dropping dead in the street or anywhere else for that matter, suddenly. So the sort of the first alerts that something is strange about this story were apparent right at the beginning, actually. I just thought I would make that point. So I thought it would be a good idea just to sort of talk you through my thought processes and how I arrived at some of my recent conclusions. And really sort of just starting off, my first thoughts that something weird was going on was actually from the UK data right at the beginning of 2020, because if you look at the regional deaths that have been reported, either excess death or COVID deaths that have been reported in the UK, all the regions basically all took off at virtually the same time, which was the time that the government instituted the lockdowns. And that's in itself is strange, because you would think that if something was spreading from somewhere, that it would, for example, there were some outlying areas, maybe north of Scotland or southwest, et cetera, which would, that their deaths would pick up dramatically, quite a bit later. You talk about something spreading across a population. There should be some sort of semblance of spread. You wouldn't expect everything to happen at the same time. But we never really had the data to be able to analyze that in fine granular detail until we found the data for Northern Italy. So myself and the colleague in Panda, we noticed that the Italian Statistics Institute published quite granular daily death data. We're talking about all causes here. We kind of ignore whether something is called a COVID death or not a COVID death because we don't think it's a useful parameter. We don't think it's accurate. We don't think it is stable over time or able to be compared between different locations. And at the end of the day, if you have had a lethal pandemic spread across a population, you should see excess death. If you don't see excess death, there's no pandemic. I think that's kind of axiomatic. If you've had a lethal pandemic, you should see raised excess deaths. So back to Italy. So this colleague of mine in Panda, who likes to remain sort of slightly in the background, his expertise is evolutionary biology and geography. And so he looked for the telltale sort of stigmata of spread. And there are mathematical tools you can use to see if deaths are spreading across an area. So I've downloaded all the data from the Italian Statistics Institute for Northern Italy, and he mathematically analyzed it to see if there was any spread. And by spread, as Nick said, two main things were looked for. One is, are there clusters of deaths? And two, do the number of deaths in one region, in one area, town, municipality, or what have you, do they relate to the region next to you? And lo and behold, they didn't. What basically happened in Northern Italy was there's a conflagration of death is claimed to have happened in Northern Italy across the whole region all at once. And I'll explain to you the significance of this now, perhaps by way of analogy. And this is a sort of forest fire analogy that I like to use. If you came across a burnt out forest and you were asked, can you tell me whether or not that burnt out forest happened by way of a fireball going off in the sky suddenly, or what, did somebody leave a barbecue in the corner and it catch fire and then spread across the forest? The interesting thing is that they both look the same. If you're looking at after the event, they both just look like a burnt out forest. You actually need to analyze a time series of events to be able to tell what happened. And if you analyze that, what happened using a time series. If basically the whole forest became ablaze all at once, and then all the fires went out at the same time, you would tend, wouldn't you, to say, that is not a barbecue in the corner of the forest spreading across the fire. That's a fireball. On the other hand, if you saw a small cluster start, and then maybe it would spread by tendrils, and a tree might catch fire, burn, fall over, sparks would flame, would hit other areas of dry tinder, and then they would set fire and everything. And then it would take a period of time for the whole forest to become ablaze. And then, of course, it would take a period of time for the whole forest, all the fires to go out naturally. That would be what you would expect by something that is spatially dependent and spreading. And so the conclusion that we came from the Northern Italy data was that it looked like something had been imposed simultaneously across the whole region. And the theory that we put forward was that that is basically policy. It is policy related. In other words, it's what we might term iatrogenic harm. It comes from things that we do, things that we change, and that causes great harm. At this point, I also like to ask people to consider a thought experiment. Let's imagine that one day the government just decided, tomorrow we're going to ban visitors from care homes. We're going to ban relatives from visiting elderly people. We're going to make them think that the elderly people are biohazards. We're going to terrorize the staff. We're going to make them do tests and then stay home if they are positive with this test we've got. We're going to ventilate them very quickly if they come in and they have a positive test. We're going to give them certain drugs, which are respiratory depressants, and so on. And if you actually imagine that you, without a virus, if you did all these things, people would basically protest in the streets. They would say, you're going to kill a lot of people. Because at the end of the day, for elderly people, the health and social care apparatus around these people is effectively their life support system. And we know from other events in history, predominantly the heat wave analysis, we know that when unusual things happen, elderly people, they get very easily tipped over and they can die very easily with just relatively small changes to health and social care. And so our theory is that these cataclysmic changes to health and social care were responsible for huge numbers of deaths in Northern Italy. So that's what I want to say really about Italy. But moving forward another year to the analysis of New York, so having developed a hypothesis that something wasn't right about the Italian story, if you look at the New York story, it looks even weirder. And myself and Jessica Hockett and Thomas Verduin, who are all Panda members, we published a paper about 3 weeks ago now on the New York City data. Because if you stand back and you look at what they claim happened in New York City, it is actually quite astonishing. So in New York, they claim that about 26,000 to 27,000 people died, more than would be normally expected, in an 11-week period in spring 2020. And just to put that into context, that's basically a 9/11 disaster worth of numbers of people dying every single week, roughly. And how can that actually be when we know from now the weight of evidence, and the same, this point applies to Italy as well, we know from the weight of evidence that whatever COVID was, whatever it was, and we all have different views on it, its infection fatality rate was basically, in a sort of healthy population, is sort of akin to flu. There's plenty of published work now showing infection fatality rate of, we might call it severe flu, we might call it a mild flu, what have you. Still, it seems bizarre that that could account for such a huge amount of death in New York City. The other thing about New York City, by the way, is that the purported COVID outbreak in New York City actually hit the young there, whereas it didn't hit the young anywhere else in the country. So actually, an astonishing statistic on the New York City deaths are that about in the 25 to 49 year old age group, about a quarter of all the deaths coded as COVID deaths in the USA actually happened in New York, whereas only 3% of that age group resides in New York. So there's something very weird about New York. Now, you can say there are two options of what to do with New York. Either what they say actually happened, in which case there should be people jumping up and down about it, saying we needed some sort of inquiry. We need to know, why did so many people die in hospital? Why was this virus, which was so comparatively mild in many places, hit that like a bomb? Why were so many young people recorded as having lost their lives in New York? That's one option. Or you can say, did this actually happen? Show us the data that proves that this event happened. What we're talking about here is the biggest mass casualty event in the history of New York City. And a mass casualty event every single week, really, for 10 or 11 weeks, which is bigger than 9/11. And the question is really, is we're putting in that article, we do put the authorities to proof, say, show us the death certificates. Because they don't have to legally show the death certificates in New York State. They do in some other states in the US, but in New York, they don't. And so far, the only proof that we have that this event took place to the extent it did, I'm not here sitting here denying that nobody died, but sitting here suggesting that there might be a huge exaggeration of what happened. The only proof that we have that actually happened are totals provided by authorities. None of the people dying have ever been listed. Death certificates have never been produced, even in an anonymized fashion. Although in many states, there is no right to anonymity after death, actually. Death certificates can be published. They can be produced by FOI. That's kind of New York. It's worth me just pointing out, I don't want to hog the whole conversation here, let Nick speak. In terms of the UK, again, it's worth pointing out that as of today, Joel Smalley, who is an analyst that I'm sure many of your listeners and viewers will be familiar with, a UK-based analyst, he has been performing some more detailed, fine-grained analysis of daily death patterns in the UK. And his conclusion from that is that in the UK, basically, regardless of age, gender, or location, the deaths which are claimed to constitute this pandemic all kicked off on the same day across the United Kingdom, and all stopped on the same day in the United Kingdom. This, again, is just highly anomalous if you're viewing a virus that is spreading across the country. And it is much more consistent with the imposition of a series of responses by way of government policy than it is of spreading pathogen. And the final point just to make is that all of this has to be viewed within the context of increasing evidence that whatever SARS-CoV-2 is, however novel it appears to have been spreading, and this really takes you back to your opening, where we're talking about the story going back before, way before spring 2020. The evidence is that whatever it was spreading for months prior to the declaration of an emergency by the WHO and then governments joining in. And the question people really have to ask themselves is, how can something which is apparently so transmissible and so lethal, how can that be spreading across several continents and becoming widely spread without apparently causing any excess death, nor any clusters of unusual illness as was reported after the declaration of the emergency? The excess death curves associated with the COVID pandemic, they kick in only after and immediately after the imposition of the declaration of the emergency. Whatever it was spreading for months beforehand, basically completely unnoticed. There's a scientific way of analyzing this. You know, there's a phrase called, you know, Occam's razor, which is basically is that the simplest explanation is not necessarily the correct one, but it becomes the default hypothesis to be knocked down by the other hypotheses. And if you see nothing happening for months on end, then a declaration of an emergency and then a huge amount of excess death claimed to have happened after that, the Occam's razor simplest explanation for what happened is that it was the declaration of the emergency itself which caused the observations. And so really, that's kind of a quick walk through my thinking and our thinking in most of Panda and most but not all of the UK-based Heart Group as well. Pretty out there stuff, I admit.
Well, it's certainly an approach that is unlikely to be readily adopted by the establishment, since, of course, it's an indictment of their entire approach to everything. So you can expect, if they acknowledge you at all, to be ridiculed, defamed, the usual sorts of things that were done to dissidents during the whole 3 years.
We've got used to that anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else is
Excuse
new?
Excuse me, this is my middle name.
Yeah.
Maybe to add just how absolutely anomalous some of this stuff is. You know, you'll look at three municipalities in Italy that are neighboring municipalities, and you'll find a ton of deaths in municipality one, nothing in municipality two, and then a ton of deaths in municipality three. And that makes no sense. And that kind of effect is visible at multiple levels of resolution. So if you step a little bit into the data, then you see within a municipality that that hospital over there had terrible outcomes and the one next door didn't. And if you step out from the data to county levels, you get different levels of mortality. And so it just doesn't, it's completely incompatible with the idea of viral spread. And just one other thing, Jonathan pointed to the potential for the data to be compatible with spread of a PCR test into an existing positive population. And I think that that's an idea that has to be taken very seriously. What I would like to point out about that is it leaves the establishment voices caught between a rock and a hard place. If they concur and say, yes, you're right, those are the statistical signs of spread of a test into an existing positive population, well, then they have to acknowledge the fact that there was no mortality when the actual pathogen was spreading. And if they say, no, you're wrong, that's not what you see, then they have to acknowledge that the data is incompatible with it being caused by a virus because there's none of this ripple and cluster effect. So it's either not deadly or it's not a pathogen at all, or it's the pathogen is irrelevant, one of the two. Both of those are fatal to the received narrative on COVID.
Let me ask you, what is your quick answer to this kind of objection, which does not touch necessarily on your thesis, but anytime I try to make any dissident remark on this subject in a hostile crowd, I get somebody saying, what, a million deaths in the United States isn't enough to get your attention and admit that this was a serious thing? What would be your rhetorical approach to that kind of comment?
I would say, look, it certainly gets our attention. We just don't think it's right to blame it on a virus because that same virus had the same spread and prevalence in other countries, Germany, Sweden, and that spread was not accompanied by a million excess deaths. Sweden didn't lock down at all, and it ended the year with all-cause mortality that was bang in line with its age and gender-adjusted 10-year average. Germany ended the year with high seroprevalence. Depending on what part of Germany you were in, you were testing between 10 and even in some places 15, 20, 25% of people testing positive for antibodies from COVID, and yet Germany didn't have excess mortality. So it can't be that the pathogen was causing this. So we're not denying that there was a very serious event. We're just saying that the event was caused by a policy response and not by a pathogen.
Well, although I didn't develop, of course, the theories that you're referring to now about the early weeks and months of all this, still I couldn't help noticing over the course of the several years that there were anomalies all over the place. Like why, for example, would Cambodia have been held up as an example of how to manage a pandemic when Cambodia was ranked somewhere around 83rd in pandemic preparation? You're telling me that the reason Cambodia's numbers were different was because they had so many public health PhDs in Cambodia? This is not plausible. And at one point, they more or less just stopped doing anything. And they saw no difference by not doing anything. And so you would see these bizarre anomalies like that. Like, what would make you think? And so, and in particular, if we look in some parts of Asia, you would see that it looked like no matter what you did, you got a basically the same result, and sometimes you got a basically pretty good result. So you had South Korea with its massive testing, but then you had Japan with its very lackluster testing and their refusal to test people without symptoms, and they had a lackluster lockdown and all this other stuff, and they basically did fine. So it looks like the policy, as you said earlier, Nick, just doesn't correspond certainly with better results anywhere. And yet it seems like it should, on some level, it seems like this should have helped. It seems like it ought to have helped. And I say that as somebody who is dead set against lockdowns and all the rest of it. It seems like it should have done some good. And it is absolutely bizarre to me that it didn't.
Yeah, a more common objection that we receive, and one that maybe we should respond to, is, you know, okay, so if you had this effect of standards of care changing, wouldn't it have been the same in other countries? But because everybody locked down, you know, there were lots of lockdowns around and so on. But what we point to there is that some of these effects are quite subtle. So they depend on the degree to which there was a take-up of the policies. And the example we like to refer to is from a pre-COVID phenomenon. There's a phenomenon known as the weekend effect. If you're going to go to hospital, it's much better to go to hospital on Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. On the weekend, there's generally lower levels of healthcare worker attendance. And that's associated with higher mortality, as in notably higher mortality. And that's for a hospital operating under normal conditions where they're supposedly trying to do the best for their patients and so on. There's no emergency conditions. So if you layer on an environment of fear and a sense of some kind of state of disaster, and you're terrifying the healthcare workers. I mean, I remember back in the early days in South Africa, there would be a tradition of banging pots and pans at the times of day when the healthcare workers were supposedly going into work or leaving work, you know, with the idea being that they were marching into their deaths. Meanwhile, the reality was that for any vaguely healthy under 70-year-old, the mortality rate from COVID is negligible. So they weren't actually going into any kind of dangerous environment, but they were being consistently told that they were. And this must have changed their attitude towards their patients, the likelihood that they would spend time in the physical presence of the people who were ill, especially these frail elderly people. And we know very well from ICU statistical investigations that the presence of healthcare workers in the immediate environs of the patient is crucially important. If you take that away, things go wrong without being noticed, and people
there's
die.
There's plenty of testimony of people both in care homes and in hospitals of how people, you know, they were told to minimize contact with patients. They were told to keep the door shut and only check on them every few hours. And there's obviously a huge number of people in different jurisdictions who pretty clearly relatives think that they're elderly loved ones died of dehydration or neglect, and putting the term broadly. So it's a very complex picture. Just to expand on what Nick was saying, there's a tendency to try to systematize the analysis of lockdown effects. So you've got your lockdown stringency index, for example, and that includes things like, well, did they shut, what size, you know, grocery stores did they shut? Did they shut gyms? Did they shut schools and everything? But the fact is that those aren't where the deaths occurred. And those stringency indexes are largely useless for analytical purposes. What you actually have to get into is the weeds of what actually was done to vulnerable people. Because New York aside, which is a bit of a weird case, across most of the world, it's pretty much accepted that the people who died were elderly and vulnerable health, you know, and vulnerable health problems. So it's really what happened in care homes and in hospitals where they were receiving elderly people with respiratory illnesses, or out in the community, how elderly people were being treated with a respiratory illness. That's what determines outcome from whatever happened. So if you take, for example, Germany, well, Germany has huge overcapacity in its health system. So it was able to accommodate a disruption in a relatively kind of disciplined and non-hysterical way in which the system didn't fall apart. Well, I can tell you that in the UK, that the National Health Service runs at very, very high capacity all the time, and it's always stretched, it's always on the edge of breaking down. And it's pretty easy to see how if you dramatically change the way people are told to work and react to patients with testing and isolation and separating patients off, it is not difficult to see how that would be a health disaster. As Nick said, we had a few years ago, one of the health ministers in the UK, he had a campaign. One of his things he wanted to bring in was, I want a 7-day NHS for exactly the reason that Nick gave, which is that patients at the weekend had a worse outcome. So you can imagine if that was detectable as a worse outcome, just as lowering of staffing levels at the weekend. Well, you can imagine when people have to, the health workers having to isolate for 10 days because somebody in their child's school tested positive or whatever, you know, they have to stay at home. The times were completely insane. One other point that's worth making about Sweden, actually, is, again, a sort of popular perception of what happened was some of the Sweden bashers like to say, well, Sweden didn't lock down and look, it had a lot of excess deaths, which actually ultimately wasn't true for the whole year, but they did experience quite a few deaths that were coded as COVID in spring 2020. And when you look into the detail, you see that Sweden, in terms of its care homes, actually resembled the UK in the sense that there was quite a bit of panic. There was a change of the way that elderly people were cared for. And when Tegnell later said, there's things we could have learned, the Sweden bashers actually said, see, even Tegnell says the lockdown policies were wrong. But actually, they don't go on to say what he actually was saying, which was there's things we could have learned in terms of the way that we handled the care home and the elderly vulnerable, not the way that the whole, I hesitate to use the word pandemic based on the foregoing, but on the whole, you know, pandemic response.
Hey, everybody, a quick message from our sponsor, Cheeky Maiden Soap. Now, those of you who are watching me on video, I have a visual aid I'm going to use in just a minute. I use Cheeky Maiden Soap because I like to be able to pronounce the ingredients of what I'm putting on my body. And natural soaps are typically made with organic ingredients, such as plant oils, essential oils, and herbs. So you're avoiding synthetic chemicals and potential irritants that are found in industrial soaps. And there's such a wide variety of these soaps at Cheeky Maiden. Now, last time I told you about Cheeky Maiden, I grabbed a few bars of soap from my bathroom and came up here to tell you about them. And it so happened that I just happened to grab like the most effeminate sounding ones. Nothing wrong with that. But I know that I have some listeners who would rather have, you know, more of a lumberjack style of soap. So for example, I've got here the Texas Ranger soap. There you go. There's a manly soap for you. Three Kings soap. Okay. King is a man. We got, Happy Thoughts soap. But yeah, men like Happy Thoughts. Come on now. Calm soap, I think that's kind of neutral. Like anybody likes to be calm. But I got all these varieties. I love knowing that I'm taking good care of myself, that I'm using soaps that are milder and gentler on my skin. They're not stripping away the natural oils of the skin. They're not causing dryness and irritation. They have their own natural moisturizing properties. Very much worth checking out. Be like Woods. And as a matter of fact, go to cheekymaidensoap.com and use code WOODS15 at checkout to get 15% off your order. Now, normally the code is WOODS. So you got to remember in your head here, this time it's WOODS15. So we're going to go to cheekymaidensoap.com and use code WOODS15 to get 15% off your order. And before you know it, you too will be bathing with your very own Texas Ranger soap, or any other variety of your choosing. Enjoy. Hasn't it turned out that among Western European countries, at least, that Sweden is first or second in terms of the good, when we say first in terms of excess deaths or all-cause mortality, yes. I mean first in terms of the lowest figures for that.
That's true. It's been quite visible and pronounced throughout the epidemic, really, except for this short period at the beginning when there was a sort of a hump in the mortality curve in their first wave. But since then, it's been very modest, normal mortality for 3 years.
And it's worth pointing out on that, actually, Nick is absolutely right that of course, this results from having effectively, you know, panicked the least. So you've got the least disruption to all your health and social care. Remember I said at the beginning that health and social care is like a life support system, particularly for elderly people. So the outcomes are most closely related to the degree of disruption within those systems. So that explains that. And interestingly also, you could almost imagine that it is an exponential thing, in the sense that if you had a huge amount of disruption, and you then, as a result of that, you then have an extra burden on your healthcare system, you could imagine that there will then be an exponential effect. If you've got a hangover of systematic failures and system changes, you could imagine that having a further knock-on harmful effect on system compared to if you basically kept a complex system. I mean, I think the lesson, you know, one of the big lessons from the last few years is that these kind of the systems that are built up and developed over decades are quite complex. And there are going to be, if you upset these systems, there will be inevitable sort of second and third order effects that you can't predict. Although what you can predict is that they are almost certainly going to be harmful. So if you disrupt a complex system, you can expect harmful second or third order effects. So this was one of the things that's so tragic about 2020, was that first of all, nobody thought of that. But secondly, nobody thought, you know, through the year to do any empirical analysis of what was happening in different countries in order to see whether it was a good idea to carry on doing it, instead of which they just carried on doing it in a sort of doubling down.
When we consider scientific explanations for events, what you're looking for is anomalies which contest the explanations. And the kind of anomalies we've pointed to, you know, really do call into question the idea that there was a novel deadly virus. It's not calling into question whether there was a virus, just a novel deadly one. Whereas when we look at our kind of approach, which is to say, okay, you know, a lot of the deaths were actually not caused by the pathogen, but caused by the response. What does that do? It reduces the implied mortality rate of the pathogen, because we've got to take all those deaths that were looking, that were labeled as COVID deaths, and subtract one of them from the attribution to COVID. And that significantly lower mortality rate that's implied when you do that is compatible with the results that we see in other countries where the panics were not as extreme. So it's a much richer and more powerful scientific explanation. There are fewer anomalies relative to that iatrogenic harms hypothesis than there are with respect to the virological hypothesis.
Where are you guys publishing this kind of material that puts this forth? And is it just people from, Nick, from your organization, or do you have people elsewhere, researchers elsewhere in the world coming to the same conclusions?
It's up on our website. And I know there are now a lot of people who are starting to reach the same conclusion. In fact, the earliest person to reach it who should be given credit is a physicist in Canada by the name of Denis Rancourt, who actually started pointing this out in 2020, whereas, you know, our work really began only at the end of 2020 into this phenomenon. So he was really early on calling it. But the Heart Group that Jonathan is also a member of has done excellent work on this. And yeah, it's carry on, Jonathan.
Yeah, as I say, also the Substack, Martin Neal and Professor Norman Fenton, or Professor Martin Neal, Professor Norman Fenton, their Substack, wherearethenumbers.com, I think. Again, yes, we'll give you the links that you can put that
I'll
in.
I'll put them up.
And I've co-authored a number of those papers, which go quite deep into iatrogenic harms and also really questioning the story about the testing and questioning also the mythology around the vanishing flu mythology. So we really do question that as a story. You remember, you've got to remember this, an important part of the establishment narrative is that COVID came and flu disappeared. And there are actually a number of data points and analyses that bring that into doubt.
Yeah, the other one that's very closely related to this area of study concerns the question of whether the symptoms of COVID are really different, the clinical signs, because you can find doctors who are just absolutely indignant at this explanation. They want to tell you that, no, but I saw it. I saw the patients presenting with an unusual pneumonia and so on. But the very interesting thing is, in the few places where doctors have been challenged to distinguish, for example, between chest scans of known COVID patients and chest scans of other viral patients, they've not been able to do so without the label accompanying the scans telling them which virus it is. And the very interesting thing is, in the Pfizer clinical trials for the vaccines, they used completely standard descriptors for what they described as COVID symptoms, fatigue, headaches, and so on. Things that you would have for any pneumonia, really, not just viral ones even. So there's this idea that, oh, well, you know, there was a unique set of symptoms, but the evidence base doesn't actually strongly support it, no matter how many doctors report anecdotally and are very adamant about it, that this was the case.
Yeah, I mean, just to build on that, actually, do you remember I said that there is evidence of spread of this virus without causing any excess deaths for months before the emergency? But not only that, there is also a complete lack of any reports written at the time about any unusual illnesses. So you'd expect, even if there wasn't excess deaths for whatever reason, you would expect this virus, which people say is, oh, it's just as much as it's a circulatory virus as a respiratory virus. It causes clots. It causes this. It causes that. None of that happened before the pandemic was declared. So there were no clusters of unusual illness at all. Even the genesis of this pandemic, which was said to be in Wuhan, you know, case zero in the hospital in Wuhan, that is basically the description of that in the paper. If you read the paper from that, the description of that is sort of common or garden pneumonia, basically. So this novelty is really questionable.
All right. Well, listen, before I let you guys go, because I want this to simmer in my folks' minds here and give them time to read things over. But I do want to ask you something that is a bit, let's say, beyond the realm of science and enters into the realm of pure opinion. And I think I know Nick's opinion. Jonathan, I don't know yours. After having looked into all this and realized that so much of what we were told, if not all of it, was, to say the least, a distortion of the facts or incorrect or whatever, a lie in some cases, or contradictory or whatever. I mean, anything you can think of to describe it seems to hold. Do you think we were dealing with gross incompetence, or do you think we were somehow dealing with some kind of sinister force?
Until a few months ago, I was very much of the view that it was a kind of emergent phenomenon. But the recent data that I've looked at, particularly the New York data, suggests that there is some form of coordination in order to make something appear to be something that it wasn't. And that would have required a degree of planning and a degree of forethought, which I don't think what we have seen can be explained by a purely emergent phenomenon. Does that answer the question?
It does indeed. Nick, what do you want to say here?
I've had a similar experience, Jonathan. I always, because my alarm bells went off so early, I have pretty much throughout regarded every element of this narrative as preposterous. So for me, so much craziness all at once, you know, when you have to sort of consider that triptych of cock-up conspiracy or emergent event, so much of it looked like it was at least a mistake, but probably a planned one, because it was so rolled out and so efficiently rolled out. I mean, it's going to be a combination of all three. But the thing that happens is we keep on coming now across instances of people preparing to do the things that they did, and those things were incompatible with guidelines, and those things were incompatible with studies that had recently been conducted. My favorite example is the contact tracing story. In 2019, the World Health Organization studied at great cost the efficacy of contact tracing in Italy in the instance of influenza, so another respiratory virus. And it came up with around zero. It didn't help at all. It was completely ineffective. And what happens is it's not only the case that they simply forget that they learned this just a few months ago, but they then obscure the fact that they'd learned it. They cover it up. The papers disappear. And they disappear not only when it turns out that contact tracing didn't work for COVID, they disappear early on in the game, before it's established whether contact tracing works for COVID. And so it's this kind of activity which pushes me in the direction of believing that there were significant elements of this phenomenon which were planned, and planned in quite a sinister fashion.
I hardly know how to respond to this. I mean, even as somebody who I thought couldn't possibly be more cynical about what happened and the management of it and the so-called mitigation measures, I can hardly use that term without snickering. But at this point, I look at the establishment, not just in the US, but I look at the, let me use this kind of term, the ruling classes around the world. And these are not normal people. They don't seem like people who have my best interests at heart. I can't rule out acts of wickedness on their part. They're not normal people. They don't act like you and me. I think some people rule out these hypotheses because they think to themselves, I would never do that. No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't. But the kind of people, the things you have to do to get into the positions these people are in, selects for a certain kind of person. And it doesn't select for you. So that's my parting thought. Now, can we leave on a happier note? Like, do you think there's any prospect of fresh thinking coming about in the world? Or is everybody just moved on or what?
Well, there's an interesting outbreak of what looks like mycoplasma pneumonia in China at the moment. If the world has come to its senses, and I'm not talking about our fearless leaders, because I agree with you, they're all perverse individuals and very, very strange. So their behavior I can't account for. But if the rest of society has come to its senses a bit, then there will not be a panic about this threatened outbreak. And we will learn that in the coming weeks, because there's very much, once again, an attempt to gin up fear about this apparent pathogenic emergence in China. I don't see it getting much traction. And if it doesn't, then you got your answer. There's at least an improvement at a societal level.
As for myself, I would say there are some grounds for cautious optimism. Obviously, we all read, you know, quite counter-narrative Substack articles, and we have our own little Twitter bubble. And so you might think to yourself, oh, everybody's waking up because everybody is getting this message. And of course, you eventually deflate your own bubble by saying, oh, it's just the people around me out there. They're not thinking that way. But what I would urge people to do is, certainly my experience in the UK, is if you take two of our mainstream, most popular newspapers, Daily Telegraph and Daily Mail, which kind of represent middle England, apologies to Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish people. But if you read the comments under the articles online version of those articles in those newspapers, it would appear that we have a hugely awake population here. And the comments underneath the articles are completely at odds with the content of many of the articles above. I haven't looked to see whether that is mirrored in any other countries, but that must be grounds for optimism.
I feel the same way. Sometimes I look at the comments and I am shocked at how informed so many people are.
Yeah.
And especially, like, for example, if we talk about Twitter, when you look at the official accounts of some of these people, I mean, some of them have learned just to shut off replies because they've learned their lesson. But they post some boilerplate post, and you know they have to have some supporters out there, yet their supporters seem to have no interest in commenting on their tweets. But you look at the comments, and they're just all cynical and devastating and smashing them. And I mean, it's almost every time an official source publishes some bit of boilerplate, the response is to, this is why, as I say, like Bill Gates doesn't bother letting people comment on his tweets, or only his own followers can, or they'll restrict it in some way. So I mean, that has to mean something. I don't know what that amounts to in the long run. I don't know if it's enough to change things, but it's something. There are a lot of people out there who do get it.
In relation to that, just one interesting observation maybe to end on is that they also appear to be using AI now in responding to counter-narrative material on Twitter. So I'll give you an example. And in fact, you can find, I've written this up as an article on Heart website and Substack. And so my co-chair, Claire Craig, that many people will be familiar with, she tweeted something about, I can't remember what it's about, something to do with the Pfizer trial data. And 42 minutes later, a very long tweet response was posted from a guy called Ralph Luckner, MD, and who describes himself as an internist in Texas. And the strange thing about this tweet was, first of all, it was 3 a.m. in the morning for him. Secondly, it appeared within 42 minutes, I think it was. It contained 15 references, 15 citations for his long response. And I went through every 15, and only the top one had anything to do with COVID whatsoever. The other 15 were random documents found on the internet about completely irrelevant things, defamation cases, judgments in cases from the Supreme Court. And so this is clearly an AI-generated response. And I would say that that must be grounds for optimism, because if they are turning to AI to respond to very reasoned, scientific, rational debate. It must be because they feel they can't cope with the volume, because nobody can think that to produce such an irrelevant response is beneficial to a human actually crafting some sort of relevant and credible response. So to me, it smacks of desperation.
And it shows that they don't trust that the general public will, in sufficient quantities, submit genuine posts of their own. So they have to come up with this lousy substitute. So Nick's website is pandata, just the way it sounds, pandata.org. I'll have a bunch of other links and articles in the description and on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2423. And this could go on for quite a long time, but it's already gone on longer than I asked these gentlemen to be with me. So I appreciate your indulgence and thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.